This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. The rule of law in the age of Trump was the subject of our program today. Our speaker was Colleen Connell, who heads up the ACLU in Illinois. She has been with the ACLU for 34 years. She is the first woman attorney to lead the ACLU. The American Civil Liberties Union has 75,000 members in the state of Illinois. She talked about the rule of law in the age of Trump and said that it is very, very endangered. As of 8/22, she pointed out, several key members of the Trump administration have been found guilty or face charges. The president is an unindicted co-conspirator of violating election laws. Colleen Connell said, unless we observe the rule of law, our very democracy is at stake. She said, people must realize that no one is above the law. All of our elected leaders must have limited exercises of power. If the power is unchecked, it might mean that might makes right. The Bill of Rights, she says, the 13th, 14th, 15th, and 19th Amendments are very central to human liberty. And she and the ACLU feels that these amendments are under attack with the current administration. In the last 20 months, she said, President Trump and his administration have failed to protect the Constitution, protect the Bill of Rights, and protect the law. Many people believe that the president, if the president does it, it can't be against the law. And that is what we must practice, eternal vigilance, to make sure that the rule of law is very, very important and carries the day in our society. Eternal vigilance, she said, is the price of liberty. So far, she said, the rule of law has held because of the court system. However, the court system has become under increasing daily attack. We need new commitment from our elected leaders and the general public. She said that Congress has the power to elect the executive, to limit the executive, but has not. And this is potentially tragic. There have been no meaningful hearings, and that is important to the rule of law and democracy. Colleen Connell concluded by saying, the rule of law protects our dignity and our decency. Everyone must get out to vote for candidates who will stand up and stand for accountability.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the invitation to return to the City Club. Many of my remarks for today's lunch were prepared before yesterday's event. So I and my colleague Ed Young had to go back to the drawing board, so to speak. But it really warrants a pause for a moment to take stock of where we are today. As of today, President Trump's first national security advisor, his campaign chair and co-chair, and his personal lawyer have all either pled guilty to or been convicted of serious felonies. And the President of the United States, as of yesterday, is an unindicted co-conspirator in violating campaign finance laws. These developments, significant reflections as they are of the strength of the rule of law, cannot obscure the fact that over the past 20 months, the Trump administration has relentlessly assaulted the rule of law and the norms of human decency that the law embodies. The country remains at risk because of this. What do we mean by the rule of law? It is a term that has meaning beyond the courtroom and beyond the law school lecture hall. It has meaning, deep meaning, for each of us. Distilled to its essence, the rule of law means that no person is above the law. Underlying this concept is the epistemological principle that the legitimacy of a democracy rests on the consent of the governed. The most important demand of the rule of law is that people in positions of authority, the president, if you will, should exercise power only within a constraining framework of well-established laws and norms, not on the basis of arbitrary presidential whim. Limiting the exercise of power matters It really matters. Permitting unchecked power recalls what we know about human beings in the state of nature. Life is short, brutish, and nasty, to quote Thomas Hobbes. Unchecked power glorifies the proposition that might makes right and allows the abuse of the weakest and most vulnerable among us. The framers of our Constitution, 60% of whom are lawyers, understood the risk and the temptation of unrestrained power. So they created a constitutional framework that required governmental officials, including the president and members of Congress, to exercise only the explicitly enumerated powers afforded them under the Constitution. The framers, more than half of whom fought in the American Revolution, emphatically rejected efforts to create an American monarch of unlimited power. What the framers opted for instead, as we all know, was a constitutional system of limited government, with the authority of the federal government divided among three branches, with each branch having only the powers explicitly granted. The framers opted for something else, too, a Bill of Rights that expansively protects rights essential to human liberty, including, as we know, the freedom to exercise one's religion, the freedom of expression, the freedom of press, to name but a few. At the heart of this liberty protected by the Constitution is the right of each of us to define our own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life itself. This expansive panoply of human rights enshrined in the Bill of Rights, and then later in the 13th, 14th, 15th, and 19th Amendments to the Constitution, reflect the founding ethos of our documents, that we the people consent to be governed because, as the preamble of the Constitution makes clear, a government is necessary to establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity. And to protect the blessings of liberty, the powers granted to our government must be limited. Limitations that are secured by dividing governmental power among the president, the Congress, and the judiciary. After watching the last 20 months, it is painful but unavoidable to conclude that President Trump and most members of his administration lack fealty to these constitutional precepts. Quite simply, President Trump does not recognize the law as a limit on his behavior. He, his advisors, and his lawyers all have repeated the mantra that if the president does it, it cannot be against the law. Shocking, isn't it? Unfortunately, at this moment of great national need, Congress has abandoned its role as an independent branch of government with a constitutional mandate to check unwarranted exercises of presidential power. Instead, the Trump majority enables his disregard for the rule of law. It abets Trump's efforts to use the power of his office to retaliate against those who would advise him of the law's restraints, be it Justice Department lawyers, federal law enforcement agents, or members of the national security community. And so, the federal judiciary, nearly alone, continues to operate as constitutionally designed. That is, the courts continue to hold each person accountable to the rule of law, including President Trump and his members and members of his administration. I am very proud of the fact that the ACLU has played an unrivaled role in defending the rule of law. In more than 20 months, the ACLU has gone to court more than 150 times to challenge actions by the president and his administration. 150 times. With our advocacy, the ACLU has demanded that the courts discharge their constitutional role in defending fundamental rights against presidential overreach. Some of the ACLU's most important work in protecting the rule of law has been on behalf of asylum seekers and immigrants. The ACLU's challenge to the Trump administration's forced family separation policy is a striking example of both the strength and the fragility of the rule of law. Our client, Ms. L, made her way to the port of San Diego. Along with her daughter, who is six, she presented herself to authorities and asked for asylum. Under U.S. law, she was then entitled to a credible fear examination, which she passed. Nonetheless, a few days later, the Trump administration took the child from Ms. L and flew the child directly to Chicago, where she was held for nearly 4 months alone. Ms. L and her child ultimately were reunited because of the ACLU's advocacy. During this litigation, we discovered the true breadth and scope of the family separation policy. Accordingly, we expanded our lawsuit to seek redress for more than 3,000 immigrant children who had been taken from their families. 3,000 children. After weeks of litigation, the federal judge in San Diego ordered the Trump administration to reunite all 3,000 children with their families. Children under five were to be reunited in 2 weeks. All children were to be reunited by July 26th. Just think about this dynamic. These children and their families had no power or authority. They had no lobbyists or pundits to appear on cable television. Many of them were in detention, being held against their will. But owing to the rule of law, the strength of the rule of law, they prevailed and forced the government to back off. Children were freed from cages. The deadline to reunite all the families has expired nearly a month ago. And tragically, the government still has not reunited all children with their parents. More than 500 children remain separated. But neither the court nor the ACLU have given up on reunifying these families. Despite the Trump administration's efforts to walk away, leaving the ACLU to solve the puzzle of reunifying families separated by language and often thousands of miles, the judge would have none of this. He has ordered the government to continue its efforts and to amp them up. This is a stellar example of a court holding the highest realm of government accountable to the rule of law. But unfortunately, forced family separation is not the only example of the administration's disregard for immigration law or the lawful authority of federal courts. Just 2 weeks ago, the ACLU filed another lawsuit challenging the Trump administration's efforts to narrow unilaterally the conditions under which one can seek asylum in this country. Specifically, the administration, without regard to either immigration law or administrative law, arbitrarily revoked the right of people to seek asylum when they are victims of gang or domestic violence. As the ACLU was in court seeking an injunction on this policy, one of our clients and her child were forcibly put on the plane by the government, and were being returned to their country while the court hearings were going on. Without hesitation, the judge, upon learning this, ordered the government to return our client and her daughter to the United States immediately. immediately. But who does that? I mean, who puts a kid on a plane and a parent when a court hearing over their fate is ongoing? You cannot come up with a more blatant disregard for the rule of law. But in the end, the rule of law held. A nameless woman from a far-off country seeking to escape abuse at the hands of a domestic partner faced off against the power of the entire federal government. And with the help of the ACLU lawyers, she prevailed. The Trump administration's attack on immigrants, unfortunately, is not limited to broad policy pronouncements. No immigrant, no matter how dire her personal situation, is safe from efforts, both grand and petty, to punish her for daring to seek sanctuary in the United States. Last year, the ACLU went to court on three separate occasions to protect the right of young immigrant women to access abortion care. The Trump Office of Refugee Resettlement, headed by a rabid anti-abortion advocate with no experience in either refugees or resettlement of refugees, blocked a young immigrant, a sexual assault survivor, from getting an abortion because he personally opposed abortion. Think about that. A government official acting on his own personal religious beliefs to stop a pregnant minor who is pregnant as a result of sexual assault from getting the health care that she needed. Although the ACLU ultimately prevailed in the appeals court, and our client was able to terminate her pregnancy, Judge Brett Kavanaugh dissented and urged the court to rule against our client. To be direct, because I've been so subtle, the administration is unlike anything we've ever seen before. It rejects legal and constitutional norms with impunity. We are seeing one example after another of Trump's disregard for the rule of law, to name but a few. He arbitrarily revoked John Brennan's security clearance, with revocations threatened for other members of our national security team. He relentlessly attacks the free press. He refuses to faithfully execute the laws passed by Congress, including the Voting Rights Act and the Affordable Care Act. Thus far, the rule of law has held, largely because of the work of the courts. But even the courts are showing signs of wear and tear. Consider the decision by the Supreme Court upholding the president's third attempt at a Muslim ban. This final version of the ban was admittedly less toxic than the first two bans. White House lawyers and DHS lawyers cleaned it up in response to multiple lawsuits, including several by the ACLU. Nonetheless, the majority of the Supreme Court upheld this ban, grading it on what can only be described as a generous presidential curve. The majority gave the Trump administration a complete pass on proving its claim that the ban would be temporary and was needed only to give the new administration time to upgrade vetting procedures and better ensure national security. By the time the Supreme Court ruled, almost a year after the executive order issuing the third ban, the Trump administration had not revised any vetting procedures. What we see is that the administration's national security concerns were but a pretext to cover the president's repeated attacks on Islam and people of the Islamic faith. Now, let me be clear. It is not my position that any court decision with which I disagree automatically becomes a threat to the rule of law. I just want to make a point about the travel ban case because I fear we are at risk that the courts, given the barrage that we've been facing, may become desensitized to the erosion of norms and adherence to the rule of law. And I fear that that process may well be accelerated by the addition of another Supreme Court justice who embraces the idea of unchecked and perhaps uncheckable executive authority. Now, tempting as it is in a speech about the rule of law, we cannot focus exclusively on the judiciary. Alexander Hamilton, long before he was a Broadway sensation, reminded us in Federalist 78 that the judiciary is the weakest branch of government. It lacks the power of either the sword or the purse. So to buttress the courts and the rule of law, we need something else. We need a renewed commitment from both our elected officials and the American people. The greatest disappointment of the last 20 months, and there have been many, has been that the majority in Congress not only has refused to defend basic norms and the rule of law, but it also has refused to provide even a modicum of oversight of this administration. Congress has broad constitutional authority to hold hearings that focus on the performance of government officials. Indeed, Congress has exercised this authority since the earliest days of our republic, holding hearings in 1792 following St. Clair's defeat at the Battle of Wabash. In the years since, we've seen meaningful congressional hearings that investigated the Teapot Dome scandal, the infamous Senator Joe McCarthy, Watergate, Iran-Contra. And yet, in the face of egregious attacks on the rule of law, this congressional majority has not held meaningful hearings on any of these issues. This, I suggest, also reflects a fundamental threat to both the rule of law and ultimately our democracy. As citizens and as Americans, we also bear a responsibility to act, or we too will be complicit in the corrosion of the rule of law and our democracy. We must not become numb to Trump's actions or fail to demand that everyone, even the president, be held to account. We must ensure that we, the people, hold this administration in check because we have seen where unchecked power will lead. It leads to confining vulnerable, innocent children in detention facilities and cages. That experience gives us an important object lesson. The president and his administration did not back off family separation because they recognized legal error or inhumanity of their ways. They changed course because of strong, strident, and continued public outcry. So, I submit, we all have a role in protecting the rule of law. To begin, we the people must tell an even more compelling narrative about why the rule of law is essential for each of us. It protects our fundamental human dignity and our human decency. And we must make that demand loudly and in public. And we must vote. And we must vote, yes, we must vote. And we must make sure everyone we know votes. But we must vote for candidates who will uphold the rule of law and demand accountability from everyone in power, including themselves and the president. I believe that we can act together, even in the shadow of Donald Trump, to protect the rule of law. Together, Americans have done great things. Although we have not ended the scourge of racism, Americans have ended government-approved segregation in the schools. Although we have not ended discrimination against those with disabilities, we did secure passage of the Americans with Disability Act. We have not ended bigotry directed at people who are gay, lesbian, or transgender, but we have opened the freedom to marry to all Americans. This progress and so many more examples confirms my faith that we, as Americans, together can protect the rule of law while we improve and secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and for future generations. I hope you will join me in this important endeavor. Thank you very much.
Okay. Colleen, thank you. That was wonderful. And in case you didn't get everything that she said, you can tune in our podcast and hear this all over again, because this was really very important and very meaningful. So we have some questions here. And if anybody... I see a bunch of blue slips going up. Whoa.
Better than pink slips.
It absolutely is. Our very first question from Roosevelt University trustee Charlie Gardner. What is the ACLU's position on the Second Amendment?
Thanks, Charlie. We think that the Supreme Court had it right before it decided the Heller decision a few years ago. But essentially, our view is that the Second Amendment allows government to put reasonable restrictions on the use of guns.
Okay. Wow.
Okay.
We have a lot of questions.
Okay.
Hey, this is the City Club. All sorts of questions are honored and asked. This is from Thomas C. Selka. Thomas, where are you?
Here.
Oh, right over there. Good. He's with the Thomas Morris Society. You talked about 3,000 children separated from their parents. How does that compare to the nearly 2,000 babies who are aborted every day and separated from their mothers?
I think that that's not an apt comparison. A woman has a right, just like a man does, to make decisions about her health care and her future. And as the Supreme Court held 45 years ago in Roe versus Wade, the decision about whether and when to become a parent is a fundamental right that's protected by the Constitution. And I submit that there is no medical procedure that our law would allow the government to decide either for men or against men. And so I think that this is, you know, quite frankly, an inapposite comparison.
Wow, Colleen, we have some tremendous questions here, let me tell you. By the way, graduate of North Dakota State University, little factoid for everybody here. That university not only gave us Colleen Connell, but more players in the National Hockey League who've attended college than any other college or university.
Can we just do a shout-out for Captain Jonathan Taves of the Blackhawks, who went to North Dakota?
Okay. Now,
I'll be at the Bill Wirtz City Club thing, so
we'll get you his autograph.
Okay.
You going to wear a jersey?
Sweater. They're
sweaters. Okay. Shows you what I know. Anyhow, This is from Stephanie Matthews, City Club member, corporate attorney. Stephanie, where are you? Oh, right over there. This is a good question. Has the ACLU ever considered instituting an evaluative and changing standard similar to the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists Doomsday Clock for freedom of speech and democratic values?
No, but it's a great idea.
Okay. Ted Manuel, City Club member, frequent contributor to the letters to the editor in our newspapers. How are consequences enforced when the executive branch fails to obey a federal court order?
Well, fortunately, we have very few of those examples. And we've never had one, of which I'm aware, probably since President Andrew Jackson refused to abide by certain laws of Congress and certain federal court orders regarding Indian removal or Native American removal. But I think it would provoke a constitutional crisis. You know, we're used to court orders that basically say to a member of the executive branch, if you don't comply with this court order, we will hold you in contempt. And the courts have, you know, significant remedies for holding people in contempt, including if it's criminal contempt, to hold that person in prison until their behavior complies with the court order. We've never quite had a situation in which the President of the United States refuses to comply with a court order. We came close in Nixon versus United States, and the U.S. Supreme Court, ordered, basically ruled against, I think in a 9-0 decision against the president. And I hope we will not see that. I think that would be a huge constitutional crisis, and we may very well be confronted with, again, to go back to Hamilton, the limitations on the federal judiciary, which controls neither the sword nor the purse. And this is why I'll come back and underscore the emphatic importance of public engagement on issues involving the rule of law. Because, those of us who remember Watergate, I think it was really in many ways public opinion after the articles of impeachment came out that really pushed Nixon to resign from office rather than go through the impeachment hearing, and I think that really reflected the fact that public opinion, which had been turning against him for some time, had turned dramatically against him, such that even his own members of Congress actually sent the signal that were the impeachment proceeding to go forward, he would be impeached. And so I'm going to hope, again, that the rule of law holds, and I want to underscore the importance of really engagement in public opinion and making sure that we continue to articulate the fact that we think that no person in this country, including the president, is above the law.
Thank you. Thank you. Two questions. One, person didn't sign their name, so normally we don't, but he said, or she said, retired general counsel of a congressional committee. So that scared me. The other is from Mary Jane Brownstein. Mary Jane, where are you? Back there. Okay. There's similar questions. In the opinion of the ACLU, is a sitting president indictable? And will the president, in your opinion, be indicted and prosecuted?
So the ACLU does not have a position on whether a sitting president can be indicted. My husband, who's also a lawyer, and I debate this every night at dinner. And, we usually, the combatants usually start first thing in the morning. And as I'm sure most people in this room, probably everybody in this room knows, the Department of Justice has issued a guidance and basically said both in as recently as 2000 that it was of the view that a sitting president cannot be indicted. There is robust legal and academic debate about that. Personally, as a lawyer, I think those who take the view that the president can be indicted have the better part of that argument. And I will say that the research that I've done over the last couple of weeks for this speech confirms that in my mind. I think that the framers really meant that no person can be above the law. And the the hypothetical I'd like to leave you with is the thought that, you know, if hypothetically President Trump shot and killed, Mrs. Trump in the White House, do we really think that that is not an indictable offense and that we would have to wait for the impeachment machinery to gear up to take action? So anyway, just that was the right answer, by the way. The Supreme Court has not ruled on this, and again, I hope let's hope that it doesn't come to bear. So
thank you. Whoa, a lot of passion there, Colleen. A lot of passion.
My husband says try the decaf.
You and your husband. Most of us, with our partners, our significant others, our spouses, we debate over Hulu versus Netflix. You guys have taken it to another level. Okay, this is from Jennifer Burrows. Jennifer, where are you at? City Club member over there. The ACLU has received significant financial donations over the past 20 months. Can you comment on how much the ACLU needs to continue fighting for the rule of law, and how do you go about raising money?
Thank you for that question. The quick answer is more than we have. I am so proud of the ACLU, both nationwide and here in Illinois. The ACLU staff has stretched and stretched and stretched and stretched itself again over the past 20 months to meet or to try to meet the demands that just keep coming in by phone, by fax, by email, and we can't keep up. But I think that it's really important for us to remember that at the end of the day, there are more of us than there are of them. When I last spoke to the City Club, the ACLU of Illinois had 25,000 members. Today, it has, as was said earlier, 75,000 members. And I think that really, really reflects the fact that that people care about these issues. And I think that when I sign the thank you notes from people across the state who contribute, I am just humbled by the fact that people really care about the Constitution and the rule of law. It means something to everyone. In fact, on my bulletin board is a note from a retired high school educator down near Granite City who had never contributed to the ACLU before, but gave because he was so worried about what's happening in this country. And those kind of letters really not only touch me, but I think really provide a window into what I like to think about as the real soul of this country, where we take the rule of law seriously and think that everybody has to answer for it. Because that's the Constitution is really what unites us as Americans. You know, to state the obvious, we are a very diverse and increasingly diverse group of people. And we don't share a religion or an ethnic or a racial heritage, but we do share our respect for the Constitution and the rule of law. And so we're going to keep fighting and we're going to keep stretching, and I'm going to keep saying thank you to all the support that the ACLU gets.
Thank you. Thank you. This is from Mike Kreloff. Michael, where are you sitting?
Michael.
Over there. I recognize that Roe versus Wade could be reversed and the right of choice could become a state-by-state decision. Is there a risk of litigation going even further? A ruling that a fetus has due process rights?
Thank you, Mike, for that question. And yes, there is that risk. I suspect many of you saw the New York Times graph last week that basically showed three possible scenarios for the erosion, the overruling, and then even going further in terms of restricting a woman's right to have an abortion. And I think there is a risk, but I hopefully think it's a small risk that the Supreme Court would basically rule that a fetus has a due process right to life that is the equivalent of the pregnant woman. And the reason I say that is that would completely upend not only abortion law, but really, quite frankly, several thousand years of medico-legal jurisprudence. You know, it goes back to, you know, really the concept of informed consent, that, you know, a doctor cannot perform an exam on a person unless he's got your consent, because your body, you know, really, quite frankly, is your body. And there are a number of court decisions in which the court has refused to order a person to give a transfusion of blood or donate a kidney or a lobe of a liver, even to a live-born family member who needs that donation of bodily tissue in order for their own life to go forward. And so, to quote the Illinois Supreme Court, if we were to really, you know, sort of, you know, change that jurisprudence, you know, we would really create a situation in which the pregnant woman and the fetus were legal adversaries from the moment of conception till the moment of birth. And that's just completely at odds, not only, I think, with our jurisprudence, but with our humanity. We really don't have, you know, it separates us from, you know, think about the dictatorships in the past, including Nazi Germany, when doctors did forced medical experiments on unwilling people. I mean, to actually force a woman to carry a pregnancy to term, or to force her to have an abortion if she doesn't want one, you know, is really, quite frankly, an invasion of a human being that's on par with nothing else I can think of.
Thank you very much. We have time just for a couple more questions. This is from Carolyn Grisco. Carolyn, where are you sitting today?
Carolyn's here.
Right here. Great. Thank you. Kavanaugh will be confirmed to the Supreme Court by all accounts. Now, I think you told me you've been with ACLU for 34 years. Mm-hmm. How do you continue your work in the face of decades of a right-wing court?
Because I'm going to outlive him and outlast him. But more seriously, you know, this is where I want to extol the virtue of the framers of the Constitution, imperfect as they were. But the federal Constitution is a floor, not a ceiling, to the protection of human rights. And what we have been able to do here in Illinois, in the face of other cycles of, you know, what I would say, not just conservative, but reactionary federal court appointments, has been to use the powers that are reserved to the people in the states in the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, and the fact that the Illinois Constitution is a much more modern document, 1970, and used the tools that are at our disposal to make Illinois a much better place, not a perfect place, but a better place for the protection of human rights. And one area in which I'm very proud to say that we have done that is in the area of reproductive rights, where 45 years of ACLU of Illinois advocacy has not only resulted in enjoining some really restrictive abortion laws. But with the unbelievable work of members of the General Assembly, including, I'm very proud to say, my own member of the Illinois General Assembly, Ann Williams, the state of Illinois has enacted laws that have begun not only to protect but to expand reproductive rights. With the enactment of House Bill 40 a few years ago that expanded funding for comprehensive reproductive health care, no matter who your insurance or insurance carrier is, but also in some other really important areas like privacy, including informational and biometrical privacy. The state of Illinois a few years ago passed what we call BIPA for short. So let me see if I can get the acronym right. It's the Bioinformation Privacy Protection Act. That was a groundbreaking act that really helped protect our own biometric information from being used, sold, and distributed against our will. Likewise, we, through the Illinois General Assembly, and again, I think Ann was one of our sponsors on this, put restrictions on the use of so-called stingrays, cell site simulators, without a warrant. And we did that a couple years before the U.S. Supreme Court ruled, like it did this term, that law enforcement has to have a warrant before it can, you know, seek cell phone location data. We've also done, you know, really positive things in Illinois, like amend our Illinois Civil Rights Act to allow lawyers to go to court on behalf of clients and to win discrimination cases when we show that the challenged action has a disparate impact on people of color or women. We're not limited to meeting that very, very high threshold of proving intent to discriminate. And so there are so many things, again, that we the people can do by, you know, being engaged on these issues, interacting with our members of the Illinois General Assembly and City Council, to really envision, you know, the blessings of liberty, to go back to that constitutional language, applying broadly to all of us. And you know, when I think back on, you know, one of the issues that has most consumed the ACLU over the past 20 months, and it's the immigration issue, what the city of Chicago, the county of Cook, and many downstate Illinois communities have done to pass welcoming city ordinances is really quite phenomenal. And this is where I want to say to all of us in the room, when we see our elected officials do the right thing, we need to thank them, we need to applaud them, and we really need to let them know that it matters. And so I hope that all of us remember to engage in that also very important act of citizenship.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I know there are some people here who are not attorneys, but if you're not an attorney, this is like a constitutional law class. And if you, pardon me?
Yes.
You could have a continuing education credit. And if not, Darby Dickerson over there from John Marshall, hopefully they'll join with my University of Illinois, and you could go to law school. And you've been to law school already. Sorry about that. Anyhow, everybody, let's give Colleen Connell a big round of applause.
Don't leave.